Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The View from Here on 95.9 FM KGVM in Bozeman, serving Southwest Montana. I'm your host, Jeff Milchin, and we're joined today by Olivia Jakubowski and Stephanie Keene, the president and vice president, respectively, of the newly formed Asian Student Interracial Association. Over 4 months of planning, the Asian Student Interracial Association, or ASIA, has become an official student organization on the Montana State University campus. ASIA strives to provide a comprehensive understanding of Asian nations, languages, cultures, and people among heritage and non-heritage students to enrich MSU and the local community. As MSU's first Pan-Asian association, ASIA hopes to foster a community united in working toward a more inclusive future. Asians are 4% of the Montana State University student body and just under 1% of Montana's population. ASIA recognizes that their efforts can and must also extend into our Bozeman community. So, welcome, Olivia and Stephanie.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Well, starting off, could you just tell listeners a little bit about your own background, what brought you to attending school at Montana State University?
Yeah, so my name is Olivia Jakubowski. I am a sophomore majoring in conservation biology and ecology and double minoring in global studies and sociology. I'm originally from Northern California, kind of at the foothills between Sacramento and Lake Tahoe. And what basically brought me to MSU was their high research focus, which undergraduate level and graduate level, they have very amazing research going on at the university. And I was just completely amazed by their ecology department and just all the opportunities Montana State offers.
All right. Stephanie?
Yes, I am Stephanie Keene. I'm a PhD student at Montana State University. I am an individual interdisciplinary PhD student, so I have a mix of disciplines, but essentially I study the impact of diet and physical activity on the bacteria in our gut, which we call the gut microbiome. I originally came to Montana not for going to graduate school specifically. I actually came here to do AmeriCorps Vista. It's a program that aims at serving disadvantaged communities locally rather than abroad. So that's actually what brought me to Montana, to really just to get away from where I had initially grown up, which is Indiana, southern Indiana, specifically around Bloomington. So it's a bit different, and I am very much enjoying it and being able to get outside and explore.
All right. And what was your AmeriCorps Vista project, Stephanie?
Yeah, it was actually at the Community Mediation Center. So it was right down Mendenhall just a bit, but it's unfortunately kind of phased out, but it was a pleasure to work with those people that were so keen on helping communities, especially families, going through tough times.
Very good. Well, why don't we start by just hearing what motivated you guys to start the ASIA group and what some of your initial plans are for your outreach and engagement?
Yeah, so I guess just a little backstory on what I guess the first steps were was just one day I was on campus just wondering if there was a way to get involved with some of the student organizations, and I wasn't able to find really any Pan-Asian associations like on campus. We have a lot of other Asian associations such as the Indian Student Association, Persian Student Association, and the Chinese Cultural Club, just to name a few. And so I walked into the Diversity and Inclusion Student Commons on campus and talked with PJ a little bit about what opportunities there are on campus, and we came to find out that there really isn't a Pan-Asian association on campus. And so after that first initial step in October, I started reaching out to different departments and got a lot of help from a lot of individuals on campus, specifically Graduate Dean Craig O'Golvie. He was a fantastic support in sharing our message, especially with the graduate department and program. But yeah, those are a couple of our first steps in starting in October.
All right. And you mentioned the Diversity Inclusion Student Commons. What is that for folks who aren't familiar?
Yeah, so that is basically a space on campus that students can go. I know they have a student commons that students can just walk in, get advice, mentorship. They have a lot of different programs on campus, whether it's with the LGBTQ plus community or diversity, ethnicity. I'm trying to think of what else they have to offer.
Yeah, they have a lot of intersectional programs. Mm-hmm. That I think that they just don't limit it to marginalized groups like of race. They really are very welcoming and supportive for whoever walks in the door. So it's a great resource to have on campus, and we've been really fortunate enough to have their input and getting started.
Did you two already know each other before discussing this idea. Tell us a little bit, Stephanie, about how this actually got started in terms of organizing.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know Olivia at all. So she, through Craig Ogilvie, the graduate dean, he had spread the word about this gal that was looking for people to help start up this Asian Student Association on campus. So I was just like, huh, we've never had one of these. This would be a fantastic resource. It doesn't exist. So through that means, I was able to communicate with Olivia over the course of December to try and help get started up, getting more people involved. And now here we are, just trying to expand our outreach to the community, not just the MSU campus.
All right. And so who else is involved at this point? And does that include faculty and staff at the university? Is it mainly student-driven, or is there a collaboration between mm-hmm. both?
I would say I think the really beautiful thing about the association so far that I've just grown to really love is how I was worried at the initial steps that it was going to be a purely like undergraduate like association or something, or there was only going to be just graduate students. But I think the really beautiful thing is that it's including undergraduates, graduates. There are faculty who are getting involved, especially at our upcoming meeting. We're going to have some faculty joining us to share their own experiences on campus and in the community. And so, yeah, we have a lot of support from different departments on campus. Trying to think of a few, like the DISC, Diversity, Inclusion, Student Commons. We have support from the Office of International Programs, Graduate Program, the Dean of Students, anyone else?
Those are the big ones. But we're still, as we're so very new, trying to get the message out there and get more people involved. Olivia had mentioned that we're trying to have more outreach with faculty and staff, which is huge because while MSU's Asian student population is 4%, that amount of staff and faculty is even smaller. So mm-hmm. bringing in such this small community to really build that inclusive community is so important, just not for students, undergraduate and graduate staff and faculty, and eventually mm-hmm. community members.
So given that the population of Montana has so few Asian people, how do you go about attracting more people to Montana, to the university, if that's part of your goal, especially if the faculty still has a lower representation than the student body? Do you have any kind of ideas on that front?
Well, bringing Asian students to MSU, that I think having our organization be amplified and our voice be present and aware, and people can say, oh, I can go to this university, I can study ecology, I can study the gut microbiome, and know that you also have the support outside of the classroom, outside of the laboratory, I think can only be a positive in bringing people, because otherwise you might look at the website and not see your face represented there per se. So mm-hmm. just having more of that appearance physically and mm-hmm. on media, I think, will just really help bridge the gap and bring more students in.
And so in the description I read from you guys in the beginning, talked pretty broadly about broadening understanding of Asian nations, languages, cultures, and people, but were there some really specific motivations driving you? Like, what do you personally hope to get out of the energy that you're putting into forming this association? Mm-hmm.
Regarding like making or having a comprehensive understanding, what we mean basically by that like mission statement is, a lot of times I feel like many times people will make the assumption that Asia is East Asia. Like we think of Japan, we think mm-hmm. of China, South Korea, and what we're really trying to hope or we're striving for is that we can provide a comprehensive understanding that Asia is East, North, South, Southeast. Even in the portrayal, like in the media and everything, we constantly see East Asian cultures being the main portrayal. And so, yeah, and so in providing a comprehensive understanding, we're hoping to kind of dismantle that idea of a lot of assumptions that are made about Asian cultures. I mean, even today we're kind of seeing it. I mean, we are seeing it with a lot of the Asian hate crimes, especially in Atlanta, with the killer being blamed for simply having a bad day. I mean, it goes back to the whole thing about the Asian, the fetishization of Asian women, the whole dragon lady trope in media, and thinking that Asian women are supposed to be delicate, docile, submissive, mm-hmm. and all of that. And so it's just the way the West has portrayed the East has been very damaging for generations, and it's all building up for today. And so, yeah, I don't know if Stephanie, if you wanted to add anything.
Do you experience that on campus? You know, you both are strong young women. Do you find a negative reaction if you assert yourself, or you know, any situations like that where you feel that stereotype impacts you personally?
I would say, from my perspective, it's very context specific. As graduate students, our working environment can be very isolating, so I don't often interact with people outside of the classroom, my laboratory. But outside of that space, it has more potential for these microaggressions, these small little statements that are targeted, but people pass off as being normal. That's when those start to accumulate. So,
how about a couple of examples, Stephanie?
Oh, yes. So I would say that my identity as an Asian American has always been framed by whiteness, that growing up, I've been called Oriental, which is not a term that we use anymore, but it kind of points at this otherness, this exoticism that Asian people will never be American. So I've always had to kind of reassert and understand my race, being second generation Filipinx. So in some circles, I'm not even seen as Asian. So among my Asian family, I don't know the language. I was essentially forced to assimilate. I was told, don't eat with your hands. Look at me when I'm talking to you. These are things that I've had to just unpack over the years as I've started to come more to terms with my identity. But thinking of here in Bozeman, I have even passed as being completely white. I've sat at a dinner downtown and had somebody across the table from me talk about his experiences with gooks and didn't even second guess what he was saying or how it would be impacting people at the table. So it's very much pervasive here. I just think that people have not really had to question it, and the conversations in the media are starting to make people think, oh, how have I contributed to this? What can I do?
Right.
Yeah, and like just my own personal experience, I mean, the difference is, it's just, in my freshman year, I really did not, I guess, it didn't affect me as much my freshman year at the university, but I think especially during the quarantine, being in quarantine, kind of like that isolation that Stephanie was saying, it's just, you're kind of stuck in a really hard situation where you're only stuck with your own thoughts and everything. But the difference between California and Montana is, in California, I'm biracial, Filipinx and white. And so in California, I was seen by my Asian friends and community that I wasn't Asian, but I would be hanging out with my white friends and I was seen as other, and they would make that known to me, whether I brought meals that my mom made from school or took school, or if it was me embracing my culture. So from my own experiences, I have never been physically discriminated against, but most of the time it's been from me embracing my culture is when I would get a lot of discriminations and microaggressions that are very painful even to today. And it's just like this self-conscious feeling of like feeling that you're other. And it goes back to the whole thing. It's like, while you might be like American on paper and everything, you're still foreign. And it's just that worry of like, even with family, especially like my grandparents, they came here in the 1960s seeking like a life of community and just a family. And the fact that generations later, being in America, they're still seen as foreign, and other communities and families are being discriminated against, dying, being killed. It's not acceptable.
So since both of you have ancestry in the Philippines, from my perception anyway, the Republic of the Philippines has a pretty low profile in the United States. We know a lot less about it than less populous nations like North Korea or South Korea and several others. So what are some of the things that people might not know about the Philippines? If you care to expound on any of your culture that would be of interest for folks to know about.
Would you like me to take this?
Yeah,
so I think what Olivia has touched on earlier is that when people think of Asia, they think of these East Asian cultures, so Chinese people, Japanese people, Korean people, and it's simply a very short-sighted view, because Asia is so diverse. There's so many countries, there's so many different cultures that can be brought together. And the Philippines, despite having been colonized by several countries over the past 400 years, really have developed this really beautiful and unique culture. Just about some history with the Philippines. So Filipinos are actually the third largest Asian group in the U.S. behind the Chinese and the Indians. And we've been here sharing our knowledge, our professional skill sets, our food for since the early 20th century. So there have been some restricted immigration laws in the 1910s and the 1920s where a lot of Asian immigration was limited, but Filipinos were actually able to migrate to the U.S. pretty freely because at the time the Philippines was an American colony. So the U.S. really has a prominent history in the Philippines. It's really rooted, unfortunately, in military occupation and the economic exploitation of its people, its lands. So I think that America and its influence on the Philippines is really touchy. That it essentially U.S. at the time was trying to create this economic trade center, make the Filipino people, the laborers, grow sugarcane so they can sell it, but they also wanted to get a stronghold in China. In that, it's kind of depreciating the Filipino labor force and not allowing people to really reach their full potential. So thinking about that lasting impact just back then in the early 20th century, even today, as Americans, we can go to the Philippines and reasonably expect to be like, I can speak English wherever I go. I can go to Manila, I can go to Mindanao, and I can speak English. And that's really because of the U.S. militarization that has been there for so long that we are have learned English. It's essentially a second language. It's one of the top nations in Asia where we have English speakers, which is, compared to some of the other countries, not as common. People don't necessarily learn English. It's something that is sought after, but not necessarily really common.
Mm-hmm. So when you talk on a more personal level about some of the interactions you have, what could someone in a position like mine do to help stem the tide of racist behavior that we've seen on the uprise in many forms in this country in the past few years, or to create a more welcoming community, maybe framing it in a positive way? Any thoughts for what some of our listeners who may not be directly experiencing some of those things are?
Yeah, I think the biggest like piece of advice, which is something that, I mean, I went to a private school, a private Christian school in elementary, and so I was pretty much surrounded by a predominantly white population. And so for me, it was very difficult to have a like comprehensive understanding of even other cultures beyond my own. But when I went to high school, it was a huge high school with a very diverse population. And so what I learned from those experiences is that it's okay to ask questions and it's okay to just reach out. And I feel like many times people are afraid of saying the wrong thing. They're afraid of overstepping a boundary. But I really believe that it's if you take that initial step in wanting to learn more, showing you're genuinely curious to learn more rather than making these assumptions, which many times becomes dangerous, which results in that fear and division that we're seeing today.
What kind of assumption, for example?
Yeah, so an assumption that, like, I'm trying to think of my own personal examples. So it's not regarding race, but it's a similar experience. But for me, like I said, I went to a private Christian school, and so I was surrounded by people of the same faith. And when I went to public school, I've heard all the stories that my friends would say about different faiths and just all these assumptions and things that I found out were all lies and things that I found out that were, of course, assumptions. And so when I went to my high school, I was curious about what is the truth about these faiths and everything. And I learned a lot from my friends, and we were able to share experiences with each other and find out that while we are might be of different faiths, and similarly we might be at different cultures, we're actually very similar, and there's a lot of things that we can relate on. But that's one example that I can think of specifically. Mm-hmm. But yeah,
thanks.
Yeah, it was getting at, you had mentioned that you haven't really had the chance to hear about these things, and I thought of a specific statement for that. So it doesn't surprise me that you haven't really heard about it, because there's a lot of barriers, perceived barriers, to why people would choose not to report things. Mm-hmm. Just thinking of, I'm a bike commuter, I bike the streets around Bozeman. the most common microaggressions that I have had as a person of color here in Bozeman have been in passing. That I'm on my bike, I'm walking somewhere, someone's in their car, they know I'm moving, they're moving, yell something out the window or out of the car, and it lasts 2 seconds and it's gone. So the reporting mechanisms, it could be like 3 blocks away from campus, but technically it's not on campus, though I am a student. Mm-hmm. So who hears about it? We have wonderful organizations like Montana Racial Equity Project that do this great work. I actually reported this incident that I'm thinking of to them because I just need someone to talk to. I'm like, what do I do? Somebody just yelled the N-word out the window. I don't identify as black, but even if somebody had, like, that could be really damaging and just question where they go, how they bike, should they consider taking another path completely, do they need friends to walk with. Mm-hmm. So as far as what listeners could do to try to help lift voices of color, I think that start having those dialogues with your family, with your friends, to help push that narrative that this is not okay. This inflammatory rhetoric that we're hearing is not normal. It's damaging. The people of color in this community, we have real concerns for safety, and it shouldn't have to be that way. I think that having our allies in the community show support, whether it's posting our Asia statement in their business window or just sharing it in their email listservs, or if they do see something, whether it's one of those instances that you happen to catch it when you're in passing, report it. Let somebody know. Let people know that it's not okay. Because sometimes people won't report it. It will just go and fix. We'll just suck it up and deal with our lives. But it doesn't have to be that way.
Right.
Well, there's obviously a cost in terms of time and energy to reporting it that you get away against. Yeah, someone said an awful thing to me, but is it worth spending half an hour of my time to go through the process of reporting it? I mean, that's got to be a tough decision a lot of times, right?
Yeah, and like, I won't like say the specific example or names or anything, but like, I know one case where somebody was really, really just, I'm trying to think of the word without being too specific, but they basically faced a hate crime in Bozeman, and the reason why this person did not report goes into the whole thing of why would I report if I'm not gonna win? Like, and that's another thing that's just the, like, people are, like, I know some people are not reporting whether it's because it might affect their livelihoods, it might affect their businesses, it might affect their obtaining their degree, whatever it might be, and so it's just, I think there's just a flaw in the reporting system that where there's that trust there. And like Stephanie was saying the other day, it's like sometimes these reports go in and it goes in a black hole. And where does it go? And so I think when people don't feel the comfortability in reporting, they just end up not reporting at all.
Mm-hmm. So I'm just putting myself in the shoes of, say, someone on the police department, if they do get a report, but without being able to have a specific name attached to it, if it were, you know, like in your case, Stephanie, you know, a passing comment, what could be done by law enforcement to help, you know, people of color feel safer in that, using those kind of examples without one where you have a name or a face to identify?
It's really hard, especially with a police department specific example, because oftentimes it can be a really difficult relationship to navigate historically.
Mm-hmm.
I think knowing that they have our backs and try to overcome the stereotypes that we have against how we're treated, I think would be fantastic to know if we have to make a report that it's going to be handled, even if it is like not attached with a name or a face, that it's just going to be handled, that they respect that we are concerned and that something will get addressed. But also to let us know about it. That idea that sometimes we can report and we just don't know what happens to it. It's kind of like, this is tough. I probably just shouldn't even do it in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
But for the people that choose to know that whoever they're telling respects that they told them, that honors that and tries to make an earnest effort to really show that they are supportive.
And speaking a little more broadly, do you have any ideas on what the city, the university, local business owners could be doing that would help increase a feeling of comfort, welcomeness, and safety on the part of people of color in the community.
I feel like this doesn't really offer a solution, but I think it kind of goes more into like the struggle or the difficulty in it is when it comes to microaggressions and implicit hate sentiments, whatever it might be, it's really hard to pinpoint. And I think that's the hard, the thing about reporting too, is like when you're reporting something, you will get a lot of people who will come to you and be like, well, are you sure that happened? Like, how do you know they were being like that? Like, how do you know they were doing that because of your race? Or like, there's been a couple times, like when I'm driving in Bozeman, that people will just, I don't know if it's because of my driving. Like, I do have a Philippine flag on the back of my car. And so I'm like thinking, like, is it because of that? Is it because of my California license plate? So it's really hard to like pinpoint some of those things. And like one time I was at the Bozeman airport and I was going through the checking and the person who was looking at my ID made me take off my hat, made me take off my glasses, made me take off my jacket, made me even untie my hair. And even then she still looked at me and was like, I guess this works. And it's like, what was that? So it's like, I can't, and it's with anybody, like it's hard to really pinpoint what the cause is.
Right.
And so when you're reporting, if you go, whether it's with the PD or the police department, like they ask, oh, so what made you think this? And it's, you know, it's just, it gets very, very fuzzy in the reporting system. But that's why it's a little bit difficult to figure out what, at least personally, what I would want to see. But yeah, like Stephanie was saying, just like showing that they're actually doing something rather than like, okay, we acknowledge this and we'll put it in a file, but actually do something.
Yeah, it's going through your daily life and just questioning in instances, do I belong here? Mm-hmm. Is it because of the flag on the back of my car? Is it because I said something? Is it because I wore this certain outfit? Just having allies in the community that don't have to make us question if we belong. I think that is huge. Having it, just showing solidarity, putting a flag in your window in your house, or just sharing and knowing that that you're supportive, that you have our backs. It's huge. It's a part of being a good ally, and there's more things that people can do to show support, to reach out to your Asian American Pacific Islander friends, check in if they're okay, see if they need anything. And sometimes, I mean, given the recent events in Atlanta, it can be exhausting. We're just trying to unpack a lot of stuff about our identities right now. And just having somebody just check in means a lot.
All right. Mm-hmm. Well, I want to go back to some of the more of the kind of proactive work the organization is hoping to accomplish. But one more kind of question on that vein that I was curious about. You know, one of Montana's senators, Steve Daines, has made a practice of echoing pretty racist, explicit language, such as calling coronavirus the China virus, and directly saying in ads, help me expose China's deadly cover-up of the China virus. So when we get behavior like that coming from people in power, you know, even with a change of administration at the presidential level, we still have a lot of political leaders espousing, you know, the most overtly racist language that I can recall in my lifetime. Any thoughts on what we can be doing to counter that? I don't expect to change the mentality of some of those folks, but how do we neutralize that or help put pressure on them to change?
I personally can't speak on behalf of what Senator Daines has said, just because I'm not really familiar with those occurrences, but my reaction, I mean, like when I would watch the news and see the past President Trump, like say those things, it just feeds into this like scapegoat narrative, where, I mean, it kind of goes into a little bit, but like, it's just a generalization and a lie that I just believe that is to take the blame off America's poor execution of handling the pandemic. And it's almost like, I'm trying to articulate the words and what I'm trying to say. But it's almost as if scapegoating. Sorry, I'm trying to articulate the words.
That's okay.
It's very heartbreaking that people in power that are supposed to represent America are sacrificing a major community of our society simply for like a scapegoating reason. And so it's just, like, it goes back to the whole thing, like on paper, we're American, but then we're still seen as foreign, and the fact that there's certain people in power who would just be willing to sacrifice an entire community group, have all these hate. I mean, I can't say if that was an intention, but obviously there was some motivation there. But it's just, yeah, I'm trying to like articulate my words, but I can't like, yeah.
Yeah, it's hard when it's something that hits you on an emotional level and kind of strikes at your.
It just feels like an attack. Like when I first heard that, it's just, you're setting the example for people in America when you call it something like the China virus. Like, I think it's hard for me to like just understand like what the motivations were behind that, because in my mind it's like you were just really trying to have a scapegoat and just kind of sweep something under the rug, so people couldn't be angry at the fact that the way we handled COVID was poorly done.
Just want to take a moment to remind folks you are listening to KGVM 95.9 FM in Bozeman on The View From Here. I'm your host, Jeff Milchen, and today we're talking with Olivia Jakubowski and Stephanie Keene of the newly formed Asian Student Interracial Association. Stephanie, anything you'd like to add on that last question of how to deal with people in positions of power espousing racist ideas?
It's a loaded question for sure, that having those people in power, as Olivia said, that are supposed to represent us, explicitly target certain individuals because of how they look for things that are going on in the world that are really hard to handle. It feels really disturbing. It's unfortunate, the fact that we have this rhetoric that is being amplified by those people in power, and it's just spreading like a virus across the U.S., reaching here in Montana. It's on billboards, it was in our campaign mailers, it's on the TV. And when you hear it that frequently, it really, unfortunately, it kind of normalizes it. It makes it acceptable to say these statements. And then fast forward, we have this increasing rise of violence against Asian Americans, Pacific Islanders, that's really, really traumatizing. It's not normal. It's really harmful to the members of our community. People are dying. People are getting hurt. Businesses are suffering. And it's, think that having this speech, inflammatory rhetoric, the xenophobic rhetoric, just be like, oh, no one's getting hurt. It's coming to this. Mm-hmm. People are. And it's unfortunate.
All right. So with your association looking, say, a couple of years down the road, what kind of activities do you hope to be engaged in, and what kind of impact do you hope to make on the campus community and the broader community in the Gallatin Valley through your efforts?
Yeah, I think in the next couple of years, like what we would really like to see, I mean, I know COVID kind of gets in the way in a lot of the things that we are hoping to do, but the summer, like I think Stephanie mentioned, Asian American Pacific Islander History Month, we have a lot of plans in store in May, even though we're not going to still be on or in classes and doing courses and everything, we're still continuing throughout the summer. So we're going to have like a film, in-person film showing of Minari, and we're also going to have hopefully about two lectures about whether it's about the current events or just topics to kind of bring awareness of the diversity of Asian cultures. And one of the things that we are kind of excited about that hopefully we can maybe do next year, depending how everything is with COVID, is having an Asian cultural night where we could just like share food, share family, like stories, experiences and everything, and just kind of embrace that diversity within Asian cultures, and especially between heritage and non-heritage students on campus and in the community. And I'm thinking of some other things that we're hoping in the next couple of years, but oh, I think another thing is also just kind of having solidarity between all the cultural associations, whether it's with Latinx, the Black Student Union. I think that's something that's very important, is that we all like have a solidarity with each other and all the BIPOC communities on campus.
Yeah, we have many plans. That collective piece that Olivia mentioned, that to know that white supremacy is harmful to Asians, it's harmful to Black people, it's harmful to Latinx, that we have these organizations on campus. We as the Asian American Interracial Association, we are so new that we're just trying to get our feet up and going, and we're going to hope to really have that more collective community, because I think MSU really needs it. We have a vibrant student population. There's a lot of great groups represented, and I think having the space, the time, the events to really celebrate what makes us so unique would be just wonderful to have. And I'm excited for it once more of our population gets the vaccine and we're able to resume having more in-person activities.
Right. This isn't necessarily directly related, but as you know, someone who's living in, near downtown in Bozeman, it's easy to overlook how much diversity there is on campus because we see far less of it downtown. And Montana State University, to me, seems more separated from the community than other places I've lived. I'm curious whether you share that perception and if you have any thoughts on whether there could be a stronger connection between the university and the city, because I know there's been staff time dedicated on both the city's part and the university's part to that, but it still feels like fairly separated communities to a greater degree than other university towns that I've been in. Any thoughts on that front?
It does kind of feel like it is a little separated. So I've been at Montana State since 2015 when I first came there as a master's student. And just to know that there are a handful of ways that MSU, from my knowledge, is trying to bridge that gap between the campus and the community. And I think that there could be a lot more growth and avenues to really make that connection, allow students to get involved with organizations, to have more outreach. I think of one specific program through the Office of Student Engagement, I believe. It's Boardroom Bobcats. Mm-hmm. I might be messing that up, but that's something that allows student leaders to explicitly go into spaces as non-voting members of boards to get experience to be involved in these processes going on in our community. But to my knowledge, I think that's one of the few, but I think there can certainly be new avenues for mm-hmm. growth. Because we have just this great community of students that would love to really start getting more involved. And we have, I think, a community that's growing and ripe for new discussions and dialogues about how to make change and make Gallatin Valley more inclusive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, another example I can think of, I'm familiar with Boardroom Bobcats, but another one I'm thinking of is Service Saturdays. It's kind of just like Saturday that I'm not too sure if graduates are involved with it, but it's I remember as a freshman they really emphasized that serving in the communities, and through that I still serve at the Montana Science Center since then, and so it's like there's opportunities on campus, but the one thing that I always wonder is getting students to actually get involved, because I know every student is a little bit different, whether how much they want to be involved in the community. So I'm still thinking of ways that you can get students to actually actively want to be involved with the community, because I feel like that's the initial step, is getting students to want to involve the community, and then the steps can like follow after that. But yeah, Service Saturdays is one of those really good opportunities to try to connect the campus with the community.
And looking at it in the other direction, do you see opportunities for community members who get involved? I know it's hard during COVID, especially when mm-hmm. most activities are not geared toward in-person participation. It makes new entry a little imposing. But any thoughts on that front?
I mean, at least with the Asian Student Interracial Association, we're really trying to emphasize like including the community. Like when we were posting our statements, like we went out into the community and gave it to some businesses to post on their business operations and everything. So we're hoping in that way, when people go to those businesses, because both students and community members go there, that they'll see that, check the QR code, because our association is open to the community, which is something we like to emphasize. But yeah, it's just, I'm trying to think of other ways. I just lost my train of thought, but yeah.
I mean, yeah, with Asia, if people in the community wanted to reach out and they don't already know about us, to just simply contact us. Mm-hmm. We have a web page which may or may not be provided with this little blurb about us on the KGVM website.
Oh, we'll certainly have a link there.
Fabulous. So I think people, it's just a matter of asking. You might not know who to contact, but if you are able to just put it out there that you're looking to get involved, whatever that might look like, you won't know until you ask if you're really engaged and just finding that right person to connect with, to really make more connections with students, to get people involved in the community.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll certainly put a web link on the webpage for streaming the show, but why don't you tell folks that, and if you're on any social media networks, to connect with you on there as well.
Yeah, so we have our website, asiamsu.wordpress.com. We also have an Instagram page and a Facebook page. I think our Instagram page is a little more active because we do a lot more sharing through stories. I'm not sure how familiar people are with Instagram, but that's something that we really use as a platform to outreach and share resources with people, especially given the recent events in Atlanta. We've been really increasing our outreach and just resources and sharing.
So for folks who are just personally curious to learn more about the culture, language, history of the Republic of the Philippines, any suggestions on that front?
Specifically Filipinos in America, and dig a little more about the history between the U.S. and the Philippines, I'd recommend reading The Latinos of Asia by Dr. Anthony Ocampo. He's out of Southern California. It's a really exceptional book that walks you through some of the history about the colonialization from the Spanish, from the U.S., and breaks down some of the early immigration policies that allowed a lot of Filipinos to come to the U.S. and some of the experiences that they've had along the way, and how that has tied in with a lot of other movements, such as the Black Power movement, the Delano grape strike in the 60s, I believe. So it's a really fantastic book that it's a quick read if you love historical facts and getting some of the policies involved, because there are a lot of them, especially since the U.S. had such a strong presence in the Philippines. And thinking of a movie that people might be interested in, it's not historical, but it's just a really fantastic tale. It's a recent movie called The Yellow Rose. It was directed by a Filipino woman. It depicts the life of a young girl in Texas wanting to become a country singer, and walks you through her struggles as being Filipino in America and having things set up against you. And I think it provides a really stark perspective for what it can be like for people that come to the U.S. and to really try to get empathy with people on just trying to pursue your dreams. And I think it's online, it might be about $10 or $15, but it's also a really good movie, really heartwarming.
All right.
Yeah, and the one I can think of, if people are maybe not too interested in reading, is on Netflix, Joe Coy, he's a comedian, and they have a bunch of different of his showings on Netflix that are really accessible, but he is hilarious, and he kind of has a more, I guess, a little bit of a more lighthearted take on, like, the Filipino-American experience, and so he's just, I really recommend him. It's very funny. My grandparents love him. I always talk to them, and they're like, oh, did you see the new Joe Coy episode? He's so funny. And just, like, always talking about all of those jokes and everything. So I really recommend him. For those who maybe want just a little bit of comedy.
All right. Well, we've had a great conversation here today. What are some closing ideas that you'd like folks to leave with or to learn about the Asian Student Interracial Association?
Our webpage is a great resource for people that may not know where to start and just want to look through some ways to learn what about current issues facing Asian peoples today. Just getting some more input on our current efforts are with the campus, with community. It would be a fantastic place to start.
Yeah, I would just say, even though we are like the Asian Student Interracial Association, to emphasize the interracial aspect of it is that we all come from very diverse backgrounds, and we're open to heritage and non-heritage students, and that also includes the community. So like Stephanie was saying, our website has so many resources for those who want to independently learn more. We're open for questions. You guys can contact us. There's just so many resources out there. Like, we have a whole books page, a music page, just a lot of ways to get surrounded by learning and just learning more about Asian cultures.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. You've been listening to The View from Here on KGBM 95.9 FM. Our guests today have been Olivia Jakubowski and Stephanie Keene of the newly formed Asian Student Interracial Association. If you caught just a piece of this and want to hear the full show online, just go to kgbm.org and look for The View from Here. And we'll see you next time. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.